Hi, and welcome to The Printcast, a podcast about the expanding world of printmaking today. I'm your host, Nick Naughton. The Printcast brings you interviews with some of the best contemporary printmakers, sharing anecdotes, business ideas, and technical tips with listeners everywhere. It's like print porn for your ears. I wanted to give some time today before the interview to catch you up on some of the latest news and happenings going on with the show. We're in the beginning of the early stages of Season 2. It was kind of a silent shift from season 1 to 2, but it's happened. And I, for one, needed a transition point where I was able to see things evolve a bit. And even if the general premise of the show is the same as before, you can expect a few new things along with the interviews with all the talented artists and printers that are coming up. So one recent experiment that I thought went pretty well was doing the IFPDA sessions on the podcast. And the unusual thing there was that I was not directly involved in the content itself. I was merely recording it and sharing it. But I feel for me, it was giving access to people something that they may not have been able to see or experience otherwise. So it's something that I think is valuable and I want to explore more. And hopefully I'll be able to do that in a number of ways coming up soon. But I don't know what people thought of that. Did you like what you heard? Was it interesting or captivating or worth the inclusion in the show? Or what did you think it was off topic in some way or unrelated to the normal episodes? Because it's not a typical interview episode when it goes like those are, where they're on stage, they're live. Sometimes there's visual aids, which makes them very hard to use in a podcast setting. But I don't know if I have a real way for you to answer these questions, of course. You can always DM me on Instagram or just write me an email at info@theprintcast.com. But it's something I am definitely thinking about, you know, whether or not to do more content that may or may not involve me or involve special events, other things happening. It's hard to say. One quality that I as a creative have is that I constantly evolve my process. I have to focus a lot to create a system and a format and stick to it for the long run. So with the podcast, I feel like I've done pretty well for me, and I'm keeping things pretty consistent, tweaking little things here and there, but generally the show has been more or less the same since the start. In the coming months, I'm going to be going to another print fair here in LA, and I'll be heading to San Juan for SGCI coming up in April. You can be sure I'll be recording and posting from those events. I also explored that with the IFPDA episodes in those like live updates I did every day. I'll have to admit it was exhausting waking up and working for like 4 hours to record, and then having to go to work and record all day, and then go to openings and try to meet people at night. And it was kind of full tilt, and like I came home just completely wiped out after like 3 days. I'll have to kind of measure what I can do for SGCI or maybe get some help and, you know, produce the show a little bit differently, but I will try to do more of the update style coming up. If I do it differently next time, I might include the voice of other people and be a little more man on the street. So we'll see how it goes. So yes, I will be in Puerto Rico coming up in April. I'm super psyched. Hope I can meet many of you listeners there while we're there. I'll hopefully have a booth, so look for me. I'll be selling cool notebooks and stuff made by me. So it'll be really exciting because I haven't been back to the island in a long time. I went quite a few years ago, and so much has happened since I was there, and it's probably going to be kind of a painful thing to see, you know. The impact of Hurricane Maria was massive all across the island, and I know rebuilding has been, you know, a huge struggle and something people work on every day. And then most recently, they had all these earthquakes, and, you know, off the south of the island, there was like this cluster of earthquakes that were happening and aftershocks. And like right now, even like there's a lot of buildings that still aren't safe to go into, like, you know, and it hasn't been that long for them to repair and rebuild from the earthquake, but it's a lot of big disasters happening in a small place. You know, only about 3 million people or something live on the island. And it's a major big deal when like a giant event happens that destroys a whole lot of housing. It's like they don't have all the materials they need for all these things to get rebuilt. You know, it's like the island has very finite resources available. So anyway, I'm excited to be there. I hope that our visit in mass will offer something to the people, to the economy, and maybe be, you know, a little tiny boost if you know, even if it's just like a drop in the bucket. They need everyone's support. And there are definitely, I'll be posting and talking about like some charities and things if you want to donate to the island and to the rebuilding effort. Yeah, more on Puerto Rico soon. Other than that, I'll be visiting an upcoming L.A. printers fair where there's a handful of print sellers hustling goods. I don't know what to expect. All the dealers are IFPDA member dealers, and it's a way smaller event, so it's not as epic as the New York show. So we'll see, and I'll let you know. And if you're out here in L.A., it's actually a little over a week from now, February 8th and 9th. I hope you can take time to check it out. It's free. It's happening at the Pasadena Sheraton Hotel. And I believe it's something like 16 vendors will be showing and selling prints. And yeah, definitely worth checking out. On with the podcast. Today, I am sharing an interview I did in the fall of last year with Valerie Luth. You might know her by her shop name, Tugboat Print Shop. Tugboat's been around in total for about 12 years. And I've followed her work since before Instagram existed, so for quite a long time. She carves and prints and does everything herself. It's all woodcut. And, you know, she sends out weekly emails that function like blog posts that come into your inbox and tell you all about what she's working on and gives you information on how to pre-order. Really smart system. And she does like print releases all throughout the year. Her stuff is fun, colorful, naturalistic, and always has a very consistent vibe that's very recognizably hers. She makes it look easy, but I know it takes a ton of hard work. And she's definitely worth a look. You can see her on Instagram and online at Tugboat Print Shop. And yeah, thanks for listening. I'll talk to y'all soon and on with the interview.
I appreciate the individuality and the uniqueness of each impression, you know. Each one is sort of different. Because I'm printing everything by hand, you know, it's not a machine. So each print, and especially when there are layers of different blocks being printed on top of each other, you know, there's just nothing is absolutely perfect, but everything is its own sort of perfect thing, you know. It's just they're all individuals.
You're listening to The Printcast, Season 2, for sophisticated arty types.
It's common today to open Instagram and see countless images of woodcut prints being revealed. You know, those enticing short videos of a print being pulled from a wet block. Lots of artists engage with audiences using social media, broadcasting their studio life, their process, and all of their finished work to the masses. My guest today has been working in the woodcut space for many years, making prints in her garage studio long before sharing or liking was even a thing. In fact, I would argue that artists like Valerie Luth of Tugboat Print Shop were forerunners in the field and helped define contemporary relief printing for the popular print scene. Her prints are unmistakably hers, and they reflect a vision that was carved out over time, edition after edition. Each piece is known for its specific use of color, the hand-drawn aesthetic, the precision of her carving, and the stylized portrayals of nature or cosmic whimsy that are often present in her compositions. Today we're going to learn more about where she finds inspiration and what it's like printing and selling woodcuts for 12 years running. Valerie Luth, welcome to the Printcast.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was a lovely intro.
Well, thank you. Yeah, welcome to the show.
Appreciate it.
And I just have to say, starting out, like, I've always wanted to meet you. It's like you never, you know, in this world, you can know about people for a long time and never encounter them in person.
Sure.
I have been following you for quite some time and following just like the development of your aesthetic and your woodcuts. But how did you arrive at woodcut as the way that you do your work?
Okay. Well, it's kind of a slow genesis. I started printmaking when I was in undergrad. I didn't end up going to graduate school, but I started when I was an undergrad. I took a printmaking, I'm going to back up. I was taking a drawing class in my first year, and the professor was the printmaking professor. And after finishing the class, he asked me if I wanted to sign on to be an assistant for his Frogman's workshop. Lloyd Menard is the name of the professor at the University of South Dakota. And I said yes. And that's kind of what introduced me or my first steps into the world of printmaking. I took a course with Mark Sisson making woodblock prints, and I made a self-portrait, and it was all right, but it didn't, and I enjoyed carving the block of wood, but it didn't really seize me as the one thing I had to continue doing for, you know, the rest of my time at university. And I continued to just experiment and went through, oh boy, I took so many different classes and tried so many different, did many different workshops, and ended up making etchings toward, you know, that was sort of what I was working on when I graduated. And it wasn't until I moved to Pittsburgh in 2006 and began Tugboat Print Shop, essentially, that started making woodblock prints again. And I think in that time that had passed, I'd really tried out so many different mediums and kind of became, that's kind of, I guess it's more, how to say, I guess it's hard to put it all back in a nutshell.
That's all right.
Oh, I'm not very good at this. Sometimes I'm kind of clumsy with how I speak. Something about the wood really grabbed me in 2006 in a completely different way than it did in 1998. I'd spent so much time making these fiddly little tiny etchings with stippling and line, tiny, tiny, tiny little lines that would take me forever to make. And it just felt very refreshing to work in woodcut lines, just bolder strokes, simplifying like my more complicated drawing style down into more, they just felt simplified version of what I'd been working on in etchings, which really helped me feel like more in control of like what I was putting down on the board, and spending a lot more time in the pencil stage, like roughing, drafting things in. It all felt very, it just clicked for me in 2006, and that's like what I wanted to be doing. And after I started making woodcuts, I just kept making them and haven't stopped adding in color. Color became a really interesting thing to experiment with, and I think for me, you know, the act of drawing is very interesting and stimulating. The act of making the matrix is very interesting and stimulating. The printing itself, the mixing of the inks, the application of ink to the matrix that you created is a very interesting step. I really enjoy all of the different steps within the printmaking medium. Sorry. Oh, I'm having a tough time with words today.
Sure. You're into process, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, I think I just end up, I am the type of person, I need lots of different activities kind of to keep me interested in things. And I like kind of jumping between different tasks. And so having all of the different tasks within printmaking that have to be accomplished in order to make a singular image is very activating to me. And also just, yes, it takes a lot of time to produce, but that time sort of allows me to think, and it makes me, I enjoy the pace. I enjoy not feeling terribly rushed working on images in print. I like the slow unfolding. I enjoy the time it takes to manifest something.
Yeah, I totally identify with that. And it seems like every type of work I try to do, because now I'm more of a day job person. So I have a day job once again from after taking many years off from that, But even now, my day job is like very compartmental, where I do many different tasks. I'm jumping between different things, and it's something about the refreshing nature of working on one thing, and then you can like put that down and work on either the next phase of that project or a different project altogether. You know, and it keeps, I don't know, it just keeps things interesting, I guess. You know, whereas if I had to do the same repetitive thing every day all day long, I would probably just like, I'd reach a point where I couldn't do that type of job anymore, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, by the time I finish carving out a block, I'm so ready to get up and go proof it and be ready standing on my feet and not be sitting in a chair.
Yeah.
And like 2 inches or 3 inches away from like a woodblock carving, you know, it feels great to get up and walk around and grab cans of ink and mix on the slab and roll the roller. But then by the time I'm done printing, I'm like, yes, I'm ready to sit in a chair and draw, or, you know, or respond to emails or whatever aspect of the business is needing to be attended to. But yeah, I enjoy wearing a lot of different hats.
Well, yeah. What, like how many prints do you make in like a given year? Like what's your output like?
I mean, it sort of fluctuates. I've had kind of a lot of things happening in my personal life that maybe have made being able to make tons of work a little bit more challenging. I'm also a mother. I have two children that are pretty young. I have a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old, Rudy and Ayla.
Wow.
And so, you know, I have to give a lot of time and energy to my children as well. But I do try to put as much time as possible into my creative efforts. I would say I probably make about 8 to 10 prints a year, but that could change, you know, depending on how much time I have available to work on it. And I find that I'm developing a new rhythm with how I work now that I am working solo, and in kind of control of every aspect of creation. That it's been about this is year 3 of me doing that. So it feels I'm starting to feel like I have a good groove with how I'm working, and it will manifest in a different way. I think even in coming months, it seems like it's kind of changing month to month as I change and decide I want to make something different or whatever. But my ability to make things happen seems to be quicker and quicker the more I do it independently as well. I mean, working in collaboration allowed for pace to happen pretty quickly as well, but then there would always be these kind of moments of, you know, deep conversational lock about decision making of what to do with this color or, you know, this thing, and you'd be kind of locked in committee for time deciding, making decisions. Whereas, you know, for me now as an independent solo artist, like, I'm able to just make my decisions and roll with them and apply them and move on. But I tend to be the type of printmaker that really likes to fuss with the details. I'm pretty meticulous person, which is probably why I found printmaking in the end. But I get pretty meticulous about, you know, the way ink is sitting on the paper, the way inks are layering, the way, everything, you know. So being personally responsible for all that over adjustment is good for me.
Well, I'm sure you're particular about materials and tools and things too. Like, what kind of wood do you prefer to carve?
I use birch plywood, like 3/4-inch birch plywood.
Oh, wow.
From the local lumber yard up the street from me. It's pretty readily available material and does the job hard but soft enough to hard enough to last through the size of editions that I print, which is usually 100 to 200 prints. So it needs to, you know, be able to hold up over long runs, but it's soft enough, you know, that I'm not totally killing myself carving it out like cherry might be or something like that, you know. And it has a nice grain, so, and kind of determine the size you want to work pretty easily. That's my medium of choice.
Yeah,
that I've been working on for 13 years.
Yeah, I definitely prefer that same wood, and I've always liked the 1/4-inch for some reason, even though it kind of has a curl to it depending on the piece of wood you get. But for some reason, whenever I use like the thicker veneers or the thicker plywoods from birch plywood, it's like the veneer tends to peel off on me, and I don't know if it's like I'm just using dull tools, which, like, sometimes I can be guilty of that when I'm just like charging through carving something. But
yeah,
when I use like the thinner one, it holds up beautifully like all the time. And, you know, and you're just you're carving through that top veneer just to get into the softer wood below. And then.
Right.
So, like you said, it's not super difficult to carve.
Well, I mean, I really like having the plies just so I can get down pretty deep. I don't really like a lot of pickup in my print. So
yeah,
being able to carve down pretty far is kind of essential to just try to keep all the areas pretty clean.
Yeah, I
like the lines to have intention, you know?
Sure. I saw that on one of your, I don't know which one, it was one of your most recent ones. You had like a process photo. Let's see. It was the Blue Ridge, I think, which you're in the midst of finishing, I'm guessing, right? Like,
Yeah. Very close. I have probably like another hour of carving left. I'm very, very excited.
Oh my God.
We're only done that today.
Yeah. That's great. That's so cool.
Yeah.
One of the photos of your block that you have on your website, like, shows just like this like 1/2-inch deep kind of gouging out of some of the wood along the edge, where I, you know, it's like you said, you don't want to like have it pick up ink on the roller like ever. So you just like carve it super deep, you know, which I appreciate because I'm always like a deep carver. And like when I carve big flat areas out, you know, they're so meticulously like flattened. And I spend all this time removing every ridge and everything just so nothing will, you know, show up later.
Well, it's fun to carve. Once you get to carving, it feels nice to smooth it all out and make it look pretty. But it also has like a utility, you know. I've been printing the blocks for so many years now, thousands and thousands of rolls, you know, through the press. So I kind of know what will pick up and what won't over time, you know, what might show up later. So I spend a lot of time, probably more time than most people, you know, at the get-go, you know, carving out, being very attentive to the areas that I carve down to try to keep all the areas clean, as clean as possible straight from the get-go, so that I don't have to go back and do as much editing after proofing.
Mm-hmm. And do you, when you're running editions, do you run, you know, say the whole edition of 100 all at once, you know, because I know a lot of your prints are multicolor, like at least two colors mm-hmm. or more. Do you run them all in one big editioning push, or do you run like part of the edition so you have some to fulfill orders and then you'll kind of redo more later, or how do you approach that?
It really sort of depends on the print and the size of the print. And oftentimes with my more complicated works, I do pre-orders, like with the current print that I'm working on, the Blue Bridge. It's just sort of a way of kind of funding the project that I'm working on that I've developed over time. And the pre-order sort of allows customers, patrons, to purchase the print while it's in production for a reduced rate. The print costs more when it's finished, and you can kind of see everything. It requires a little bit of a stretch of the imagination and a trust in what I'm doing to pre-order, because, you know, there's no backseats. But that can sort of inform, you know, how I really know, like, how many I need to require, you know, to fulfill the pre-orders that I have and the edition itself. So sometimes if it's, you know, I'll have the bulk of the edition will be sold in a pre-order, and I'll have to, you know, the whole edition will definitely be printed all at once in that case, of course. Sometimes if the print is a little larger or more tricky to print or requires more effort in the application of the ink, I might do more of a batch printing. The lightning print that I made before, the Blue Bridge here, I'm kind of doing that one in batches because the rainbow roll across it is sort of tricky to lay down.
Yeah,
I was. It's challenging. So.
Well, sure, because you need that brightness to shoot right through that center point. And I would imagine they kind of like start to work themselves out over time to where that blend won't hit the way you want it to. So you have to like redo that, right? Like,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. Anytime you're doing split fountains, you always have to kind of, I mean, you got to clear them back every, you know, 10, 20 sometimes, depending on how many colors you got going on.
Yeah.
Because they definitely will blend. And then you'll end up with something very different. I mean, I appreciate the individuality and the uniqueness of each impression, you know. Each one is sort of different. Because I'm printing everything by hand, you know, it's not a machine. So each print, and especially when there are layers of different blocks being printed on top of each other, you know, there's just nothing is absolutely perfect, but everything is its own sort of perfect thing, you know. It's just they're all individual, all the prints. But I try to keep it as uniform as possible, and I'm pretty meticulous about that, so it's usually pretty darn close. But, you know, there is always, it's not like a computer printout. Looking at a real actual woodcut print is not like looking at a digital print at all. There's a sculpturalness to the way that the ink layers on top of itself. You can see the grain from the block through the layers. And, you know, just through the application of ink might be very, very, very slightly less, you know, of ink rolled across one block in one particular print that might be slightly darker in the next print, but have a slightly lighter next, you know, following color on the top. But they all sort of end up looking about the same. And I try to keep everything as close as possible to the same thing. But, you know, there's variation in printmaking, especially woodcut.
Yeah, it's hard to control it completely. And I mean, I'm sure over time, as you've done it and practiced so much, like, I'm sure you're pretty on top of it now to, like, maintain color density and ink layer, you know.
Oh, sure.
And viscosity and everything.
Endless troubleshooting. Always, you know, because every block of wood is different. So you never know what you're going to get, you know, what knot will decide it wants to print light, or, you know, there will always be these sort of wild loops that are thrown in every time I'm printing. But, you know, I've been doing it for long enough now that I've troubleshot so many different problems that I have a wheelhouse, you know, to draw from and trying to solve issues. And it goes a lot faster for me nowadays than it would initially. But yeah, there's always the puzzling of how to make it look exactly like you want it to look, you know. And I very much enjoy that puzzling, but it certainly requires time and effort.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so what, you're using oil-based inks, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and what brands do you like in your ink choice?
Charbonneau is my favorite. Charbonneau etching ink.
They have a good, good pigment density. It's like really good and high quality.
Yeah, it's lovely.
In looking at your process over the years, like, one of the main ways I keep up with what you're doing is, like, I get these email blasts that you put out, and I feel like I've been signed up on your email list for like a long time, like many, many years, because I don't know, off and on, I just follow like all printmaking things, you know, in the world. And
awesome.
And your emails, like, I always find, first of all, it's just interesting because it stands out today, because I just recently got an email of yours and it was like talking about your new print and it was showing the blocks and then you can pre-order if you want. And so it's like this really interesting approach that, like, compared to where everyone else on the print scene works today, it's like everyone's on Instagram and they're all like, prints in my bio, link in my bio and all these things. And I'm sure you do that because you have to now, but you still work in this way that kind of harkens back to times before social media and, like, the way that you share and kind of promote. But, like, how does that function for you? Like, do you get a lot of conversion from, like, email blasts, like, for people who buy your prints? Do you find it's, like, the same people buying over and over, or collectors or things like that? Or how do the sales work on your end?
Certainly have patrons, you know, people, customers that have been purchasing prints for many years or have collections of tugboat prints, and often purchase new prints as they're made. I think all of the different means to relay what you're doing, as far as like social media or newsletter or just online presence or any of them, they all kind of have different voices that are sort of required or different nuances to feel like you have a successful voice on any particular platform necessarily. It doesn't really work to do the same thing on every one, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, as my time has gotten a little shorter, you know, sometimes I now have it linked with my Facebook page and my Instagram. So when I post an Instagram photo, you know, it's posting to my Facebook page or whatever. But I kind of respect that people follow, you know, different social media for different reasons, and what they might want to see from those particular platforms is different. You know, when I'm on Instagram, I don't really want to see a ton of words. I want to look at pictures, you know.
Yeah.
And when I'm on Twitter, you know, it seems more, like, you know, it's nice to see some pictures, but it's definitely, there's text. You need text, you know. And I think I've always, in addition to being a very visual person, I've always really enjoyed, like, taking pictures of things and writing. So to me, like, explaining what I'm working on or trying to relay, trying to package it all in a nutshell, you know, so that it's easily understood and isn't obnoxious to take in, I guess. You know, it's so easy to just feel like you could just write a ton of things down about any particular subject. But I find that, you know, being a fewer words that have more direct relation to what you're talking about tends to be a more successful path. So the newsletters, to me, I was realizing I wrote my 191th newsletter the other day.
Wow.
Like, wow, I've really made a lot of these. It's sort of just like I enjoy doing it. I always take photos of things that I'm working on. So I always have the photos of things. You know, I definitely have thoughts about what I'm working on. So it helps to, you know, keep people informed on what I'm working on to send the newsletter. There are definitely customers that purchase via newsletter that don't necessarily follow me on social media, or, you know, that might be their preferred way to hear news.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's vice versa, people who, you know, see your Instagram and then click through and do that kind of version too. I mean, how many of the, when you're in the pre-sale phase and you're carving away on all the blocks and promoting like the project that's in lieu of being finished, like how much pre-sale activity do you get? Like, do you get a good portion of those prints sold ahead of time or no?
I would say yes.
Yeah.
I mean, considering like the size of editions being 100 to 200 prints, you know, like, ultimately, like, edition sizes kind of got to be that big just because, you know, making something, I didn't want it to be gone 2 months after, 2 or 3 months after making it, you know?
Yeah.
I needed
yeah.
to have enough prints to stick around long enough to have something to show for myself, you know? And thankfully, in printmaking, you can make more prints, more multiples. But
well, that was also wondering too, like if once you make an edition, say like, you know, you made a really cool print of like the moon, I think that this is like from mm-hmm. a while ago, but it was really huge and I saw it in person and I was like super, I don't know, thrilled by just like seeing it in person. It was really beautiful. And when you make something like that, like how long do you have copies of a print generally? Like, does it go in a year or two? Or, I mean, I'm sure it varies between project too, but.
It does vary, you know, it depends on the image. Some images are just more popular than others. I try not to let that like guide how I make things. I don't want to just be making things that feel popular or feel like I'm making this because I want to sell a whole bunch of prints. I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. I want to sell prints, but mostly, you know, there's something to be relayed through the making that is beyond just the sales for me, you know, and the moon sold pretty fast, honestly, but.
Well, and when you sell, say the moon one or any of the editions, like when you sell them, do you have like wholesale options? Cause I've seen them in stores.
No.
So no. So, when I see them in a shop, are they bought just by the business or yeah.
Most likely. There have been some like sporadic relationships with shops that have happened over the years. I mean, not that it's spread. I think it's mostly just like, it's hard to have prints like sitting somewhere on a shelf when I know that I can, they could be sold through the website. You know, I mean, there are ultimately 100 or 200 prints really isn't that many prints.
Yeah,
think about like how
definitely.
Many people exists in the world, you know, how many people might be interested in a particular image. I mean, 100 or 200 of something really isn't that many. So I don't know, you know, I find that printmaking itself is kind of a challenging thing to be running your business doing, like meeting a lot of other makers, you know, bag makers or jewelry makers, you know, they're able to make an object and manufacture it infinitely, but you know, a print has an edition, there's a cap. And you know, once that cap is reached, the blocks don't really perform forever, you know, so you kind of set it aside, you know, it's done. But so it's a different kind of thing to market. It's a different, you know, it's a conundrum really. there's no easy way to be doing it. I mean, I think you might have been asking me if I reprint prints. Is that what you were getting at when you asked me about like the edition of the moon? The moon, the maximum I will print of anything is 200. Sometimes that will be like I'll print 100 of something and then it flies off the shelf and people keep asking me about it. And so I'll print a second edition. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I won't print more than 200 of anything. So if I do print a first edition of 100 and I end up printing later a second edition of the same print of another 100, I mark the second edition with like a Roman numeral. So it's marked as being different from the first edition.
Mm-hmm.
But I really, you know, people want the prints. If they want the print, I mean, I'm happy to print it for them so long as it fits into that. Like, I don't want to be working on something beyond 200 copies. But if it's up until then, yeah.
Yeah.
Happy to help people connect with an image if they want it.
When you retire a piece, what do you do with the woodblocks? Do you keep them all? Do you have them all in your studio?
I do keep them. Yes, I do keep them. Well, I take photos of them before I print them, usually after I finish carving, before I print them, because as you know, as you're inking a block, it really, they fill in, they look completely different by the time you're done printing.
Yes,
you know?
Definitely.
Yeah. A lot of people will ask me, you know, like, are my woodblocks for sale? You know, and I say no. I'm not trying to sell the blocks. The prints are what I was making, you know. The blocks are sort of like a keepsake for my own effort there. And also I use the blocks in exhibitions. I like to show process, be able to hang the blocks up next to the print to sort of show how it was made. So they have a usefulness beyond their print life.
Well, definitely. Well, so yeah, I was going to ask about, do you do many like public events and fairs and things like that?
I'm kind of getting back into doing things like that. For a while, I stepped back from it. Initially, when Tugboat first started, like back in 2006, 2007, 2008, running around doing lots of different fairs, different shows, different exhibitions, and then even up until like probably around the time my daughter was born, I started doing fewer of those shows. They're pretty taxing and
Definitely, took
a lot of time and energy to do. And it felt better to just be pouring my energy into the work and into, you know, my daughter. It's trickier to plan to be away from the shop for me now. So I do sort of have more of a home-based operation. My studio's in a garage on my property in the backyard. So it's sort of separate from my home, but I'm able to, you know, work throughout the day and keep my projects out and keep moving forward.
Man, it's like the dream. You've really cracked the nut of like how to do all of it. You don't have to do events.
There's plenty more nuts to crack.
I mean, yeah, but you know what I mean? Like you don't have to do events unless you want to. You don't have to be a professor full time. Like you get to make your work not based on sales or demand, but based on just like what you want to do. I mean,
well, sure, but you know, it's all got its stresses.
Oh, sure, yeah, no, that's not to say it doesn't.
I mean, I enjoy doing events. I really enjoy doing it. I love talking to people directly. I really enjoy sharing what I make with people directly. That has always been something I've really loved. And I like hearing people's reaction to things. I like hearing their questions. I really enjoy how everyone has a different take on how they perceive what they're seeing at my table, you know, when I have prints out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of miss that from time to time. And then I'll do a show and then I'm like, whoa, well, that was a lot of work. You know, I'm just going to go carve a block for a little bit longer. But, you know, I do enjoy doing it and I will continue to do it. I just am not able to do it all the time anymore.
Sure. Yeah. And I imagine, yeah, doing everything solo now as you are, it's also like, it is a ton of work to do events, especially if you have to travel. And I can imagine like having a family and everything, like what that must require for you to go take off for like 4 days or 3 days to go do an event is kind of a lot to put together and make happen.
Sure. Yeah. It is. I mean, I've started doing sort of some workshops and teaching things as well. So that's kind of taking the place of some of the more like tabling events is more educational outreach. Not that I'm necessarily, you know, I like I told you earlier, it was never really my plan to be a professor or a teacher, but I do feel like it's important to give back. And I want to be able to share what I do with people who are interested in learning about it. And I know that my take is probably different than many other printmakers, woodcut artists. And so it feels good. And I enjoy teaching when I'm doing a workshop, but it also feels good to get home and, you know, get back to my projects as always. But that's another thing I've kind of been embracing more and more.
Sure. Well, I've always loved teaching, and I'm at a point where I'm not pursuing like full-time academia anymore or anything like that. But there's something that no matter what, if I get into a classroom and I get to work with a bunch of students, no matter what the age even, you know, they reveal things to you that you've overlooked or things you may have forgotten about as your process evolved. And you see people break rules where you wouldn't even consider doing that at some point because your process gets tighter and more efficient, you know? And then it's like you see people do things and you're like, huh, like I forget that I can do it that way, or I could, you know what I mean? It's, it can be liberating and inspiring to work with people.
Yes. Yes. You know. I do like people.
Yeah.
I am often hermited away working on my things, but I do enjoy people.
Yeah, we printmakers may hang out alone a lot, but we like people.
That is so true. You know, I think one of the things that really attracted to me about printmaking also initially was like the community and the print shop itself kind of being this shared environment where, you know, you have to share equipment. It's all really expensive. So
yeah,
you kind of rely on this place and everybody has to work together. And yeah, it's really a lovely, lovely dynamic that happens in the print shop. But it's different when you have your own print shop and you don't necessarily have to share everything. But I really enjoy the community of printmaking.
I think it's like two different beasts, you know, because I know people who run community shops and I tried for a little bit to run my own, but it became just like my own studio after a time. And I think for me, it's like, I like the control of like knowing where everything's at. Nothing's going to get messed up by anyone but me. And, you know, and it's like, I need things a certain way for me to just do the work I'm doing, because I'm often like doing a lot of work or lots of intricate processes, or I have tools that like I absolutely can't have messed up because I can't replace them because they're expensive, or, you know, so many things. Cans of ink, I don't want someone to gouge because they don't know doing. Or
Yes, yes.
And that's the trade-off. But then it's like, I end up being isolated for wanting that control. And, you know, it's kind of back and forth. And so it's like, I find myself like reaching out, wanting just input and community. And then I want to retract and go back to where I'm like controlling everything once again. And I don't know, it's just back and forth for me, but.
Yeah. It's nice to be in a room where there are a bunch of printmakers like sitting and like just carving on something, though, you know.
Yeah,
like
when I'm teaching
my little workshops, like and all the students are working on their projects and everybody's just, you know, has their head into their wood blocks and is carving away. There's something, they were all in there working in the same room together, but everybody's kind of got something different going on. But the energy, you know, that's happening with all that work, it just feels, it activates the room, you know. There's something very enlivening about it.
Oh, it's just the best. Can't beat that. Well, so when you're working on your imagery, like I was mentioning, I think in the intro, like it's become very naturalistic. Like there's lots of nature scenes, like you're working with like lightning and plants and leaves and all these things. And I remember like earlier works from Tugboat were often, I don't know, they were just different in flavor. Like there was like the big United States one that I remember, like, which I've seen in person. And that one is like epic and really detailed and just like, you know, you kind of do the landscape of the United States, like along with like sort of a map presentation of it. And then the moon print, which was also like really large scale and like really intricately carved. But there was more of like a nostalgia sort of thing in the earlier works versus like what I see today. Like, how do you approach, you know, finding your subject matter? Is it just like the things inspiring you as you live in Pittsburgh, I believe, right?
Is it
like the landscape that informs you, or how do you pick what to make a print of?
You know, I don't know. I think I just like keep myself open to that. I just, the channels are always open for inspiration. I try to be present in the way that I live my life and kind of not rush. I don't like rushing around. I like walking everywhere if I can. So I like to look, I like to walk, I like to interact and talk with people. I like to get down and study things that I see as I'm walking past. And it all sort of informs what I'm interested in making. I mean, I have kind of a pile of ideas, you know, that I want to have manifest, but, you know, it's a slow process. So I choose one and work with it and then do another one and then another one and then another one. And then some of them, they kind of bind together into different ideas. Like two ideas might kind of loop together by the time I start working on one or the other. I don't know. You know, it's sort of a stream of consciousness choice right now. I don't necessarily want to be working in a series. It feels good to just be making what I feel compelled to make because that's where I want to put my energy. I feel like I want to go to work and work on that because I feel good about that image. And that was the same was true when I was making America and was drawing the moon. That America the Beautiful print was made for a show in DC, for Manifest Hope. DC was like an inaugural big art celebration when Barack Obama became president. So that was a piece that was conceived and contributed to that exhibition. The idea of, you know, making a giant, I sort of wanted to make like a cake of America. Initially, like a giant, like celebratory cake. But then which is why the mountains sort of look like frosting and like there's this kind of three-dimensionality to like the way the landscape is looked at, but also simplified down to. But yeah, that piece had like a, you know, it was a themed show. So it was a reaction to the topic of the exhibition, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the moon has always been of interest to me. I think the moon is just, I don't know, you know, I'm always following its cycles. I feel very, like right now, today is a full moon. You know, it makes me feel like a maniac. I can't keep my words straight, but all everything is just so bonkers. But I feel very connected to like natural rhythms, and something of in the moon just it pulls the waters, you know.
Oh, I know. Well, I'm a Cancer. I don't know about you, but I feel it.
Oh,
like
I'm a Sagittarian.
I feel it all the time. Like every change, like I'll just be in a grumpy mood and I'll be like, oh, it's a full moon today. I was like, oh, you know, it, like makes sense and I can feel it. And I don't know, whatever, if people believe in astrology or not, like there's something underlying that I think makes sense beyond like people's superstitions and things, you know, but I've also felt the pull for it to the moon and lots of natural things, honestly.
It was really fun to draw the moon so big up close and to think about, you know, where the Marias are, where the craters are, and like transport myself there while I was drawing it, you know, all in reverse. Same with America. You know?
Oh yeah, I didn't even think about that. Yeah,
messed that up in the first pencil drawing. Forgot about that, but then had to, you know, go back, erase, redo. But yeah, everything in reverse. But it was I don't know. Like that's the thing. I think when making, it's a great time to sit and reflect while you're drawing and carving, and I like that aspect of it too, just thinking on a subject that I like very much, the moon.
Well, yeah, and think now, since you made that print, which I don't know how long ago it was, but it was quite a few years ago, like 6 or 8 years or something now, like right now on the moon are like all these like spacecrafts that have been landing there and crash landing there. Like recently, like I think Israel had a spaceship crash. Was it Israel? But it like had tardigrades on it, so now like they like tardigrade creatures are like on the moon, put there by human beings. And
oh my goodness,
I think China or was it India had a lander that landed, and they actually grew, or maybe it was Japan, I'm getting all mixed up, but they recently, someone grew they sprouted a plant like on the moon, and it
in
only
the moon soil.
Well, it was like, it was in a contained kind of thing, because apparently when the shadow kind of falls, it gets so cold that like they literally have no way of keeping it warm enough to survive. So they sprouted a sprout and then it died like right after. But it was, you know, the first organic thing just grew on the moon, like in the past like month or two. It's like incredible.
Oh my goodness, what an accomplishment! That's crazy.
But
Now I'll be thinking about that. Thank you, Nick.
Yeah, I digress. Maybe that's the next print. But
yes.
I definitely wanted to see, like, if you had any advice, because, you know, and when I'm looking through and like researching and seeing what's going on in the print world, it's like there are so many new people on the scene that, you know, are trying to get somewhere, and they're trying to make their work, they're trying to sell their work. And I was wondering if you had any insight or thoughts for people who might want to be like what you're doing, like full time printing. But it's just like, how do they go about that? Like, what should they do? Or, you know.
I don't think there's any easy answer.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's all hard work, and you have to be ready to do it. And I think that's the thing, is that, you know, everybody's different. Whatever what you're making is different. You have to find an audience that enjoys what you do. You gotta put yourself in front of the people that appreciate it, or find the people that appreciate what you're doing. You know, that can take some time and effort, but it can be very satisfying when you do connect with individuals that respond.
Oh, definitely.
But well, I mean, I don't really have a formula that I could necessarily, you know, give that would work for everybody. You know, I try to keep what I do pretty simple, because it's not my favorite thing necessarily to be running a business. What I want to be doing is, you know, just making work. Running the business is something that ends up taking more and more of my time, but I'm happy to do it because it allows me to make my work. But, you know, it's not necessarily something that everyone would want to do. You really have to enjoy talking with people, enjoy connecting with people, and enjoy the many, many, many different tasks that you will have to do to get yourself connected to your audience.
Yeah, no, that's definitely well put. It's, you have to be self-driven, you know, because no one's going to make you get up and carve that block today. And you have to want to, and you have to be okay with like what you're making and feel confident that it's worth putting the effort in. Because some people have to, you know, they second guess their ideas before they even make them, or they think too much going into the process, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't like things to feel too formulaic. I get creeped out by that. I just, like, I don't want my life to feel like a formula. I don't want what I'm working on to feel like a formula. And fortunately, you know, I kind of have to constantly be shifting what I'm working on, so that, you know, I'm not just propelling one thing forever and ever and ever. But I'm not a fan of like a prescribed way of doing things all the same always. Necessarily, you know, you learn from what you do and you can apply it to the next project, but like, I want things to feel organic. I want things to feel alive. I don't want them to feel like they're just plunked into a box. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that's partly why you're succeeding at doing it, is that sense of feeling alive, because I feel like you've like activated your practice and your career, and it's like you keep feeding it and it keeps growing and going on, you know. But I think if you were to like stop making prints, like the, you know, the momentum would kind of slow down, and the energy behind it all would kind of dissipate, I guess. That's how I see it, is.
Yeah. I mean, very possibly.
Like a career is like a living thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You have to tend it.
Yeah. Just like
take care of it. Give it a little water.
Just like that plant on the moon, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Well, I guess I think we've covered everything, unless there's anything else you'd like to talk about. I have one last thing I'd like to get to. I'm doing a new segment on the show that's called Let's Get Technical.
Let's get technical.
I wanted to see if there's anything that you can't live without in your studio practice. This could be like a tool or a tip or a trick or like a type of ink, or, you know, you have to put Easy Wipe in all your inks, or you have to have it tackier so you add this thing, or you really like this brayer and without that you seem to can't get the right ink layer. Like, what, what's like one thing, what's one thing that's pivotal?
That's,
that could be true too.
I print with Masonite and not felt. I would say that, you know, that would be something that's different, maybe different for some.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting thing. I've always been kind of unsure as to, because I never use a press, so I don't know what people do. Rubber blankets is one solution for running through. But yeah, so Masonite, so you put down your block on the bed and then your paper and then Masonite on top of that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I have favorite tools, favorite brayers, favorite inks, favorite time of day to be rolling blocks.
Yeah.
When the favorite time, like I really like having my inking station near a window or near like light source, so that you can see, you know, you can get a sense of the layer you're rolling out across a block so much nicer when you have real light shining in, reflecting off the gloss of the ink.
Mm-hmm.
I found that's something I really look at. I've realized over the years that it's very helpful to have a natural light source in the print shop.
I agree. Or at least have some major consideration for light, because I've had jobs that went really bad, like commercial types of printing I did, but stuff where it's like I tried my damnedest to like match a color, and then I took it outside and it was like way orange, and it was like not supposed to be orange at all. And lighting in your studio or where you're doing the ink is super important to like have an accurate outcome. You know, when it leaves the studio, it has to look the same way, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's a great tip, and I think people should think about that. When you're mixing color, I was going to ask earlier, do you go by just like feel, like you know you want like a light blue, and so you'll just kind of mix until you achieve that? Or do you use like a Pantone or mixing system of some kind? Or
It's all by eye, eyeball in it. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I might print, you know, 20 different proofs of something, subtly changing the color until I get what I want specific, you know, before I start additioning.
Yeah.
Like I'll really fine tune what the amount of pigment that I put in each of my piles of ink that I'm going to be printing, you know, and really get them to exactly what I want them to be before I start additioning.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to go. And
I mean, it's hard because you end up printing like a lot of proofs, or for me anyway, because I'm particular, but I find like if I'm going to print 100 to 200 or something, like, and when I get to the ink slab and I'm starting on that, like, I don't really want to have to be guessing, or I don't want to have to be troubleshooting anymore. I want to just know what I'm doing and be able to roll the color and just do that again and again and again and again, and again, you know, when I'm additioning. Mm-hmm. But when I'm in the mode to proof and I'm just experimenting, I'm happy to like try out like different, lots of different color combinations.
Sure.
Because it helps you learn, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's a pain. Yeah. You know, I got to strip your block, all of the things, but then every time I do it, I always learn so much. So I just always do it.
Yeah, that's a great way to proceed. And like, and when you're doing your color layers, do you carve the key block first and then transfer that onto the subsequent parts of like color layer wood?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it sort of depends on the image. You know, like in the sort of full color style that I've been working on, that will usually be like, I'll take the key and the key will usually be the overall guide for how everything kind of comes together on top of all the colors. So it will sit on top of all of the color blocks when they're finished too. So that will be very easy, and it'll just like roll it up the ink and transfer to two or three or four color blocks. But sometimes I'll make, you know, one component of an image that will have another component on a different block, and all of the key, so like all of the blocks are sort of like keys, you know, that work together to build an image in different colors, not necessarily overlapping or, you know, there's lots of different strategies you can approach woodcut and how you roll the ink on and how you layer the blocks, or if they layer at all, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on the project. Sometimes I'll have a more CMYK approach. Sometimes it will be more like spot colors, like this block is just going to hold these pink flowers or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was something I was definitely wondering about. And registration, what kind of system do you use to register each layer?
I use a wooden jig.
Oh, just like an L-shaped kind of jig, or like what mm-hmm. kind of, yeah? Okay. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. simple enough, but surprisingly you can get like perfect registration from that type of thing.
Well, I think it's all like sleight of hand, you know?
Yeah.
You have to really be watching what you're doing when you're printing. And if you want it to be the same all the time, I find I want things to be sort of perfect, but I don't necessarily want them to be absolutely perfect to the point where they feel cold, you know. Mm-hmm. I want them to feel handmade and to have the aliveness that something handmade has. So, you know, most of the time the blocks all line up exactly on top of each other or so close that you wouldn't notice it being any way otherwise. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's just, I always lay things exactly the same way. My hands kind of have a motion that they just have developed over the years. I train my eye to look for certain things. My hands move a certain way and I rely on that. And I know that it will always be the same because I'm very attentive to it.
Yeah.
But it's when I'm not thinking about it and not paying attention to it that I end up with terribly off register prints. I realized so. I have to have my mellow going for printing time.
Well, yeah, it's like a flow state. Once you get into it, everything just kind of goes. And yeah, and I'm sure
it does.
At a certain point, you don't mess up nearly as much as you may have back in the day. So,
Totally.
Well, I think we've covered everything I was planning on discussing with you. Like, do you have anything you'd like to promote at the end of the show here? Like, I guess for one, the print that we were talking about, the newest edition from Tugboat.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, all of my prints are available on my website at www. Do you even have to say www anymore?
I don't know, maybe.
It's tugboatprintshop.com, you know, at tugboatprintshop.com. And I like I was saying before, you know, I take a lot of pictures of my process. I take a lot of pictures of things as they're developing. So if you're interested in seeing how I make my work and the process that is required to make woodcut prints, you can see a lot of photos documenting that on my website as well. Each print is sort of, there's a story of making with each print on the website that's accessible. I also have an Etsy store if that's your jam. And I do studio appointments. So if you're in Pittsburgh and you want to come check out Tugboat Print Shop, write me an email or send a text and try to set up a time so you can come say hi.
Well, that's great. I hope people do. And if I'm in Pittsburgh, I'll definitely hit you up and come see your studio. I'd love to.
That would be great.
But thank you again for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate your time and for taking time, especially because you're like an hour out from finishing a woodblock. Like, it's got to be just like eating you alive inside right now.
Oh, maybe. And that's probably why I'm a little scrambly.
But good luck with that. I'm excited to see the final outcome of this new edition of yours. And everybody should just look you up and see what you're doing, because I think there's a lot of value in the process and everything that you post. And you know, I think people could gain a lot just from seeing like how you do this or how you do that or how you present what you do, because it's great work. So.
Oh, well, thank you, Nick. I appreciate it. And thanks for having me on the print cast. Definitely. I think what you're doing here is really neat. And I look forward to hearing all the interviews that will come in the coming months and years as you work on it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff is coming down the pipe here in the next few months. So keep an eye out.
Excellent. Excellent. I will. Okay. Our ears. Okay. Ears out.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Well, do keep in touch. And yeah, we'll talk soon.
You've been listening to The Printcast, a podcast about print shops, the artist, the process, and all the things we make. If you like what you were listening to, help us get the word out by subscribing and leaving a 5-star review and sharing with your friends on social media. You can find The Printcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, as well as on the website printcast.com. Music for the show is by Jazar. Voiceover provided by Jim Bertzall and Rhiannon Bertzall. Take care of yourselves and each other, and we'll see you again on another episode of The Printcast. Bye for now.